Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last weekend in Florida, eight potential candidates to head the Democratic Party made their cases for the party's way ahead, its way back to winning. It's a tall order and a subject of fierce debate after the Kerry loss last month. Tonight we'll hear it. What is the winning fight for this party? We'll hear from Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, who is following the Democrats' struggle to define a winning focus for the party. We'll hear from the editor of the New Republic, Peter Beinart, who says, in order to succeed, the Democrats must turn hawkish and make the war on terror central to the party's image, as Democrats did with the Cold War 50 years ago. And we'll turn to David Cerrotta, who argues, no, that it's going to be a fiery, progressive, populist referendum on the status quo that turns the tide for the Democrats. Tonight on Point, the Democratic Party debates its way forward. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the best way ahead for the Democrats? To the center or to the left? Howard Dean and Michael Moore, or Joe Lieberman and the centrist DLC? What's missing from the Democrats' message that has left the GOP with the White House, Congress, and so much of state government across the country? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Cerrotta. He's a fellow at the Center for American Progress. He wrote a cover story in January's issue of the American Prospect about how a populist economic message helped elect a wave of Democrats in traditionally red states this fall. He wants to see that kind of talk in national Democratic politics. David Cerrotta, thanks so much, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you right here.
Good to be here, and hello to our guest.
So we're going to hear a number of perspectives tonight, and they do not all add up to necessarily a unified and harmonious chorus. But it's all about searching the way ahead for a party that has lost on a number of fronts in very painful ways recently. David Cerrotta, give us the heart of your argument. This party is looking for that winning message that's also true to its values. Where do you see it?
Well, specifically, my article was about the economic agenda and domestic agenda that the Democrats have put forward. And my argument is pretty simple, is that if you look at which Democrats are winning in traditionally conservative, you know, red America, the Democrats who are winning are not the sort of corporate centrist profile that has been prescribed as their answer. In fact, the Democrats who are winning are, by and large, progressive economic populists. And by that I mean politicians who are willing to challenge corporate power and corporations' influence on the political structure. And I go through seven different ways that these winning politicians are doing this, everything from fighting for family farmers against agribusiness to fighting white-collar crime to fighting on behalf of small business in the face of larger and larger corporations.
We want you to take us into some of those. You call it the Da Vinci Code, a roadmap to political divinity. That sounds like something anybody would like these days. You get the religion and victory all wrapped up together there. But we got to hear, I guess, the detail, because fighting for family farmers, what are they, 1% of the population, 0.1% of the population? How does that add up to victory?
Well, because essentially, if you look at the map, there is a huge swath of rural America that is voting Republican, and they are essentially voting against their economic interest. In each of these states, for instance, the Dakotas, Iowa, et cetera, you've got many family farmers who are struggling to get by as agribusiness gets bigger and bigger. And let me just say, fighting for family farmers, when a politician fights for family farmers, they're not just appealing to the votes of family farmers. They are transcending into a values debate. They are saying, I understand our state's way of life, attracting voters not just from family farmers, but from people who understand that family agriculture is a state's way of life.
So every case you make is symbolic or iconic in a way, and you're saying that one speaks to values, and God bless family farmers, but it's magnified beyond them, they say. Walk us through your Da Vinci Code for the Democrats here, David. What else have you got? So fight for family farms against corporate agribusiness. What else?
Well, there is also what I say is fight the class war, and by that I mean many times the Republicans have impugned Democrats for talking about issues of rich and poor, and more broadly about having a class analysis, that is, speaking in class terms, rich and poor. And
that's supposed to be taboo.
That is supposed to be taboo, and that's the problem. The Democrats have allowed this class warfare attack to emasculate them. They're afraid of it. And part of the reason they're afraid of it is because when you talk about class issues, you ultimately get to a discussion of trade policy. Now, I would argue that trade policy, the Democrats' embrace of a free trade, corporate trade policy, has totally decimated their ability to speak to working class people throughout the heartland of America.
You mean you cannot support working class people without being a protectionist? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not saying...
Another taboo word?
I am not a protectionist, and I don't advocate protectionism. What I think we have now is a trade policy that puts corporate interests far ahead of people's interests. So, essentially, if you can't propose an alternative trade policy to the free trade policy we have, you can't speak to people who've lost their jobs, thousands of people who've lost their manufacturing jobs, thousands more who are afraid of outsourcing.
What's the alternative other than protectionism?
Well, I think that you need to have a trade policy that is a hybrid. A trade policy says that, yes, we want trade, we want to lower tariffs, but the only way we're going to lower tariffs is if we first, and I stress the word first, have serious investment in job retraining, serious trade adjustment assistance. So essentially, instead of immediately ripping down trade barriers, you first prepare your workforce for the transition, and then you, in a graduated way, go to a more liberalized trade.
So policy. Kind of warm embrace of those who are threatened by that. So class war, bring it on, you say, champion small business over big business. George Bush made much of his embrace of small business. Is that hug still open to the Democrats?
Well, I have argued, and I was out in the Montana race where Governor Brian Schweitzer he became governor out there for the first time in 20 years. One of his key strategies was to basically separate small businesses from the big corporate interests as the Republican base. And how he did that was, look, small businesses are conservative. Small business people are generally trend conservative on taxes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
However, their votes are open to an appeal from politicians who are willing to speak to the problem of, say, Walmart coming into local economies, underselling, destroying local economies, and destroying local business.
So that's the populist way of getting a handle on the small business issue. Go after Walmart, you're saying?
Well, it's go after Walmart. It's go after tax loopholes. It's go after out-of-state corporations who are not paying their fair share. It's and it's also a positive agenda. It's saying, you know, let's find ways that small businesses can cut costs themselves, pool their resources together, pool together for health care.
Mm. So we won't necessarily get all these in detail, but you say go after the hunters and the exurbs people, make them green, make them environmentalists. They're going to be sympathetic to that. You say clean up government, make that a Democratic campaign battering ram, go out against corrupt, wasteful, incompetent leaders. Then you say become a Teddy Roosevelt clone, you advise the Democrats. What do you mean?
Right. Well, in sort of the model of Teddy Roosevelt, and now updated today to New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, this is having the guts to seriously investigate corporate excesses, corporate crime. The problem is that for years, Democrats have been boxed in on this, and they're afraid of being called, quote-unquote, anti-business. Now, what Elliot Spitzer and Teddy Roosevelt showed was that you can fight corporate crime, you can fight corporate excess, and that actually those fights are pro-business, because what you're doing is trying to protect the integrity of the market. And this is a prime place that Democrats can go to be both pro-business and populist.
And finally, you say, use the values prism, though it's not God, guns, and gold that you would have Democrats pick up. You say Democrats should redefine the values debate on economic and class terms, and I think people can understand within your context what you mean by that. But let me ask you, David Sirota, Bill Clinton won two terms and an awful lot of praise from many quarters, not for doing what you're describing here, but doing just the opposite. Why are you giving a reverse prescription for Democrats now?
Well, I would disagree with the premise. I would argue that in 1992, the vaunted campaign that people, the DLC and the centrists sort of say is the model, Bill Clinton ran as an economic populist. He ran as somebody who was against unfair trade deals that sold out American workers. He ran as somebody who was pro-middle class. Now, he governed differently, but Bill Clinton taught us in 1992 that populism works. Now, how that's been reinterpreted in a sort of historical revisionism is another thing.
But you can pour almost anything into the populist bottle, right? No two populists are necessarily the same.
But when I mean populist for Clinton, I mean he was a guy who was willing to talk about rich and poor, something that Democrats barely talk about anymore. He was a guy who was willing to talk about how the government was keeping the middle class down. These are things that Democrats haven't been doing, and they should be doing. And, you know, I really believe that Clinton in 92, the seminal campaign, was a model. It's not a sort of something that says that what I'm saying is not true. It's actually a validator.
Jack Beatty, jump in here with us. David Serrata says he's got the Da Vinci Code for the Democrats. It's fight the class war, get on the side of small business against Walmart and other big corporate interests, clean up government, be a Teddy Roosevelt kind of crusader on that front, and use the values prism in a new way, looking at it, redefining it as in economic and class terms. So how about it? Do you see victory for the Democrats in them their hills or more time in the wilderness?
Well, you know, I've been thinking these things and even writing them for 20-odd years, so I think he's got something. At the same time, I have to be skeptical even of my own prejudices, and one of them is that this vocabulary of rich and poor, we have poor in this country and we have rich people, but most Americans think of themselves as middle class. And one of the main achievements of the Democratic Party in recent years has been attaching to it professionals for the first time ever for the Democrats in 2000. They captured the vote of professionals. That's very important. Those people don't think of themselves as poor. They don't think of themselves as rich. And I think that the Democrats, there's a moral appeal to that, but it can also frighten away people who regard that as sort of antediluvian and don't see things in those terms. I think there's a very delicate line a Democrat has to walk there, and they do it by fudging with phrases like working families and that sort of thing. They don't want to say working class. What I'm suggesting is that class is not so easy, is a double-edged sword when a Democrat picks it up. And it isn't just because Republicans can say you're waving class warfare. It's because it puts off a lot of people who really don't see America in those terms.
Yeah, David Serrata, but yet you're proposing it, you're pushing it. Are you missing something here? Are Americans so open to that class war theme? Or is it still everybody could win the lottery, everybody could become the zillionaire CEO, and it, as Jack Beatty says, it cuts two ways.
Well, I think this is first of all, I agree with Jack in saying that, you know, when I meant rich and poor, I meant as a construct. You don't necessarily have to go out there and, you know, talk about the poor rising up against the rich. So I agree with him in that. In terms of
the class war suggests something along those lines, however Democrats might like to think of it as a construct.
Right. Well, what I would say is that I think that you can frame a construct of the middle class and a more powerful elite that is benefiting from the political system. And the question really is, and this is my belief, is that it is a chicken and egg proposition. Meaning, sure, right now, if you went out and polled and asked people questions like this, it's possible you might not get in a sort of a national poll a class consciousness. But a class consciousness is there. It requires leadership. If leaders begin to speak like this, as I've shown, leaders in their own congressional districts, leaders in states, leaders on state and federal tickets, if leaders talk like this, if leaders see the world like this, they can help raise people's class consciousness to a point where it is politically important.
And what about the leaders who were meeting this last weekend down in Buena Vista Lake, Florida, talking about new leadership for the Democratic National Committee? Do you see them generally, the top ranks of Democratic leadership, as open to this cry or wary of it?
I do. I see some of them being far more open to it than others. I think that the key down there is that, honestly, The only kind of figure who's going to head the Democratic Party, who's, I think, going to be open to this kind of thing, is somebody who is not from Washington. An outside of Washington person will be more able to embrace this kind of thing.
David Serrata, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Jack Beatty, we'll be right back. We're talking about Democrats searching for their new direction, debating what that direction should be. What's the winning way ahead for the Dems? To the center or to the left? To Howard Dean and Michael Moore and MoveOn.org? or to Joe Lieberman, centrist in the DLC, what's missing from the Democrats' message? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Democrats searching for their new direction. You can join the conversation. What is missing from the Democrats' message that has left the GOP with the White House, Congress, and so much of state government? What's your forward strategy for the Democratic Party? And did John Kerry lose the race, or did the party? Where should the Democrats plant their flag now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with me in the studio tonight. We've just heard from David Serrata, a fellow at the Center for American Progress, with a big article in January's American Prospect magazine. Joining us right now from Washington is Peter Beinart. He's editor of The New Republic. He wrote an article in the latest issue of the magazine saying that the key for the Democratic Party is to embrace the war on terror and make it central to the party's platform. Piece has inspired a lot of controversy among Democrats, got a lot of things stirred up. Peter Beinart, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
So you say, let's look back to 1947 and where the Democrats were then, decisions that were made then. You say a similar decision has to be made now. Give us the history list, if you would, Peter.
Yeah. In 1947, there was a struggle amongst Democrats, amongst liberals, about whether to make anti-communism central to what being a liberal meant. There was a very fierce battle over that between people who saw communism as the central defining challenge that liberals had to face and those who didn't. The anti-communists won, and I think that was what reassured the country that liberals could be trusted in an era where America faced a totalitarian enemy. And it's also what allowed liberals to put into place many of the policies that allowed America to contain and eventually defeat the Soviet Union. I think there are some parallels between that time and today. I think since September 11th, liberals have not made this struggle against totalitarian Islam the defining passion that of what it means to be a liberal. Not the only one, of course, but seeing it as essential, the essential center of what liberalism needs to mean in a post-9/11 world. I think that's part of the reason they lost to George W. Bush, and it's part of the reason that the party hasn't found the rallying cry it needs.
John Kerry was very explicit and deliberate in most of his big public speeches, saying he would go after the terrorists. He would practically saying he'd kill them with his bare hands. I mean, there was an effort to signal that. Where do you see the evidence that the Democrats came across as soft in the war on terror, or as you put it, on totalitarian Islam?
Well, I think one thing you can see, just if you looked at, for instance, the polls of Democratic delegates at the convention, you saw how small a number of them said that defense or terrorism or homeland security were their number one issues. I think you could see that in the primary debate, except for the debate over Iraq and the debate over civil liberties, which were essentially negative debates about policies that liberals didn't like that Bush was pursuing. There wasn't very much passion for a positive agenda on how to defeat al-Qaeda and its ideology. And I think the thing about which John Kerry was the most passionate that came through the clearest was his call for multilateralism, his call for a reuniting between America and its allies. But that was not the moral vision. I think that did not compete as a moral vision with the moral vision that George W. Bush much more explicitly laid out about bringing freedom to the Muslim world and keeping America safe that way. I think in many ways those words by George W. Bush were hollow given how weak his policies were been. But I think that was a much more rousing message for Americans than John Kerry's, which was that we would bring America back with its traditional allies to work together.
Half a century ago, you remind us, there were Democrats who were called the softs, as in soft on communism at that time. So how do you see the softs today, and what's the view that you would say is the soft Democratic view on totalitarian Islam?
The view that I call soft is actually a term from a magazine article in 1950. I think are people who basically see liberalism's opponents or liberalism's enemies, liberalism's fights, almost exclusively on the right, against enemies, conservative enemies, primarily at home. And I think that's true. That's the perspective of someone like Michael Moore, and I think it's the perspective to some degree of the leadership, if not all of the members, certainly, of a group like MoveOn.org. Michael Moore and MoveOn both opposed the war in Afghanistan. They both responded immediately to 9/11 by saying America should not respond by going to war, and they have both at various times minimized the threat from totalitarian Islam, while I think hyping the threat from America's from liberals, conservative, domestic opponents. Not that I don't think we have many issues to fight with against George W. Bush and the Republicans, but I think that has been a fundamental problem of emphasis which has contributed to a kind of lack of passion for defeating al-Qaeda on the liberal grassroots.
So a couple of questions then. Number one, does that mean embracing the war in Iraq, a pretty difficult affair, though we're in the middle of it now? And number two, what about the criticism you hear from some Democrats, and certainly globally, that America's got itself wound up into a kind of paroxysm of fear that is blinding it to many different ways of approaching the threat from Islamist terrorism? What about those two?
Well, let me take the second first. The threat is real, it seems to me. It's not obviously the same as the Soviet threat, but the consequences, particularly for the things that liberals care about, of al-Qaeda detonating a weapon of mass destruction in the United States, the consequences for civil liberties, are overwhelming, and the people who know this issue best say the chances of that are very real. So I don't think the threat is hyped, and in fact, if you minimize, you cannot simultaneously minimize the threat and attack George W. Bush for, say, underfunding Homeland Security. Those two things are in tension. I think that's one of the problems that people like Michael Moore have. They want to have that both ways, and it undermines their argument. I think the threat is real, and America does not have a realist tradition. Americans have tended to throw themselves into the world because they want to make it better. That is the only kind of moral argument, that language, a moral language, that's going to work, I think, politically in the United States, and I think that there is a very valuable tradition, a liberal tradition, behind it. On Iraq, I would say that the people of goodwill can absolutely disagree on Iraq. We at the New Republic supported the war in Iraq, but we have had, we published an issue earlier this year called Were We Wrong, where we and many other liberal hawks wondered self-critically about whether we had too much faith in the Bush administration. But I would say this, the critique of Iraq has to be framed in terms of what liberals would do instead, not simply opposing what George W. Bush has done, but how liberals would use American power more effectively, more aggressively to defeat the threat.
Peter Beinart is editor of The New Republic. He writes, Islamist totalitarianism, like Soviet totalitarianism before it, threatens the United States and the aspirations of millions across the world. And as long as that threat remains, defeating it must be liberalism's North Star. Listeners, what do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Is that your North Star? David Serrata, with your agenda on the home front, a much more domestically focused agenda, do you see Peter Beinart's vision of a fighting faith in the Democratic corner, kind of hawkish on terrorism Democratic Party, as compatible with what you've got in mind, or at odds?
I definitely don't think that they're at odds. I think that what I have laid out was an economic domestic strategy, and I think what Peter's saying has some validity. I think that he wrongly caricatures the grassroots organizations, and unfortunately, I actually think that he takes some of the right-wing language and right-wing false characterizations of groups like Move On and Michael Moore to prove his point. I think Peter's point is valid, that Democrats do have an opportunity and do have a necessity to sharpen their message on terrorism, on the war on terror. Bob Graham, senator from Florida, had a great message on this, saying that the reason the war in Iraq was wrong was because it took the eye off the ball of the real threat towards America. But I think that his characterization of the grassroots is just a little bit oversimplified. I think that there is a grassroots constituency out there for the kinds of things he's talking about, and I think that those grassroots constituencies did not oppose necessarily what he's saying in the kind of way that he's saying. And I think that really that he has proposed a prescription, and I think I've proposed a domestic prescription that is broadly appealing to the party, as long as we don't get into the idea of saying certain segments of the party, especially of the grassroots, are not sort of available to this kind of argument.
Peter Beinart writes, Michael Moore views totalitarian Islam the way Wallace a half a century ago viewed communism, as a phantom, a ruse employed by the only enemies that matter, those on the right. Saudi extremists may have brought down the Twin Towers, but the real menace is the Carlyle Group. Jack Beattie, what do you think of this whole view of the world? A dukes up, fighting faith in the Democratic corner, is that the way to win?
It may be politically the way to win. I note that Bush, 49% of the people said Bush was the only one who could fight the war on terror, and he got practically all but 2% of that vote, which was the election. So clearly terrorism, people believed that he was a strong leader, and they pointed to the fact we hadn't had another attack, and they credited Bush with that. So clearly there's something to be said for it politically. I just wonder about it as a matter of policy. I mean, a crusade or an attack or a culture conf, whatever you want to call it, built around opposing something called totalitarian Islam, I think it incurs unnecessary dangers. For one thing, an attack on totalitarian Islam can be heard as an attack on Islam. So that, like the Iraq War itself, you wind up feeding your enemies in the name of defeating them.
Put it together with the pictures of Abu Ghraib, and it looks like a general attack.
Yeah. Second, bin Ladenism, tragically, which I guess is totalitarian Islam, is seen by many in the Muslim world as a reform movement, an antidote, an opposition to the hated regimes battened up and, you know, propped up by America over the Cold War while we were on that crusade. And we just can't, you know, escape from that past. And that raises, of course, again, the other problem. We don't have the moral authority. The Pentagon recently had a study from their science board, you know, basically saying that the word democracy on a president's lips in the Middle East to Arabs sounds like love on the lips of a whore. We simply, after post-Abu Ghraib, post-Fallujah, post-the regimes, we simply have nothing. People don't believe us when we talk about these things. And finally, of course, it's our policies, as this defense board pointed out, that our enemies say they don't like, our relationship with Israel and our basing troops in Saudi Arabia. We've taken the troops out, and let's hope that the new Palestinian leadership offers us a chance to go ahead in the Middle East, because it seems to me that a genuine solution to that tragic conflict would do more for our interest in the world than a kind of, you know, propaganda attack on totalitarian Islam.
Peter Beinart, how about it? Jack says, well, yes, it may win some elections, but it may bring more dangers than profit for the country overall.
I really couldn't disagree more. It seems to me that totalitarian Islam is actually the very force that is blighting the lives of so many people in the Muslim world, particularly women, religious minorities, anyone really with a thirst for freedom or modernity. That is really their enemy, and in fact, they know it, many of them more than us, which is why it seems to me it is reformers in the Muslim world who are our strongest constituency. Yes. Yes, they have great suspicions about the United States, but their suspicions about the United States are partly, it's true, due to the Arab-Israeli conflict that we have to be involved in, but they are largely because America is seen as not having supported democracy and human rights in their part of the world, as not having really been committed to that. And an American effort, a serious American effort to do that, an effort on the scale of the Marshall Plan or the Peace Corps, these were liberal efforts, one should remember, that were explicitly targeted to spread freedom and economic progress in order to defeat communism.
So you say pick up the Wilsonian torch that President Bush has right now. Is there a difference in the way Democrats would hold that torch from George Bush?
Well, the difference is that for President Bush, it's in fact all talk, and I think that is part of what creates the cynicism. If you look
all
at
talk,
actual,
he's got 148,000 troops on the ground in Iraq.
That's right, but the rhetoric, I mean, the actual resources that we have put into things like creating educational opportunities in the Muslim world so kids don't have to go to these madrasas where they're taught a barbaric form of Islam and taught to hate us.
Do they want American schools?
They certainly, in fact, Pervez Musharraf, it's reported, asked the United States to give some of the money that we were going to give them in military aid to in economic aid precisely for efforts like this, and the Bush administration refused. There is a great hunger, it seems to me. Look at the Arab Human Development Report. There is a recognition and a hunger, in fact, for opportunities for modernity and liberalism in the Muslim world so people don't have to choose between secular authoritarian regimes and Islamist alternatives. Mm. And in fact, that is what, not the United States alone. Read chapter 12 of the 9/11 Commission report. It says it almost better than anyone else. It calls for the United States to throw itself into an effort with a recognition that only politically can we ultimately defeat this threat.
Mm. Democrats with a fighting faith, anti-totalitarianism, Islamist totalitarianism as liberals' North Star. Listeners, what do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Carlos is calling from Boston. Hi, Carlos. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right. I compliment the point that the Democrats lost the election long before the actual election when they went along and gave Bush the authority to go to war with Iraq. Because it seems to me that as soon as they gave him the vote, they started trying to come up with all these excuses why they were supporting that. And John Kerry exemplified that. I mean, I voted for Kerry. I think Bush is a disaster, and I love the quote about, you know, democracy from his mouth is like love from a whore. That's great. And I think the Democrats really have to move along from that, move away from that.
But what then about Peter Beinart's argument that they have to make anti-Islamist totalitarianism their North Star? Would you put that as the guiding star for this party, Carlos?
Well, I sure think that that's a good way to go. However, they're in a different position to offer a different view from George Bush. I mean, these Republicans have done a great job framing the argument. I mean, it's all the war on terror. Well, you're going to go to the war on terror, like, as in, like, you're going to go into everywhere that there's a terrorist?
It's a tall order, no doubt about it, Carlos. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get another call in here. David is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I originally wanted to get in on a domestic subject, but
it's still on the table. David Serrata is with us. Pick it up.
Okay. Well, let me say briefly, you know, on the terrorist thing, it's not a choice between hard or soft. It's a question between, you know, smart and dumb. The biggest winner in the war against terrorism, as George Bush has conducted it, is Iran. You know, he's about to, we're about to watch Iraq fall apart. And the biggest winner there is going to be the Iranian Shiite group.
So would you be happy to see the Democrats pick up the war on terror, just make it a Democrat war, but claim it, make it theirs, make it their North Star?
I think all we have to do is wait a couple years, and George Bush's policy will destroy itself. On the domestic front, let me talk to your other guests for a minute. I think that the Democrats clearly need to heighten their rhetoric and be much more aggressive on the whole economic front. But I think we're missing an opportunity here if we go back to the kind of New Deal rhetoric of rich and poor, you know, corporations versus, you know, the masses. The Republicans have proposed this ownership concept, which is really fascinating because I think what they've done, what they've realized between Karl Rove and that other guy, Lutz, whatever his name is,
yep.
That what they've realized is that, you know, the mass of the people, you know, really want to join the property class. They want to rise into the, you know, the stable middle-class America.
Right, so don't shout them down too hard or you're shouting down somebody's dreams. David Strader, I want to hear from you on just that point, but Peter Beinart first, I know we have to let you go in just a second. What about on the domestic side? Does your hawkish view abroad affect American Democratic Party domestic policy one way or another, what you prescribe?
I think it's actually very helpful. I mean, I think one of the lessons of the Cold War, both of the late 1940s and of the early 1960s, is the way in which these things can help one another, in the way in which the credibility that liberals get by showing that they can protect America can help them in their moral arguments at home. In fact, liberals used quite effectively during the Cold War the argument, for instance, that America had to be a model in the world, that we could not fight communism abroad unless we allowed civil rights at home, for instance, that there was a national security dimension to making America a strong, just, free society at home. I think the two things are morally compatible. They're even morally essential to one another, and liberals need to recapture that.
Peter Beinart, editor of The New Republic, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
We're talking about Democrats searching for their new direction. You can join the conversation. Where should the Democratic Party plant its flag now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David Serrata will be right back to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Democrats searching for their new direction, debating what that direction should be. You can join the conversation tonight. Can the Democrats win the center again, Clinton style? Should they? Do they win as progressives, as populists, as deficit hawks? Should the Democrats become super warriors on terror? And what's the good fight, the winning fight for this party? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by David Serrata, a fellow at the Center for American Progress. He joins us from Washington, and also from Washington right now, by E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His latest column was The Democrats' Rove Envy. E.J. Dionne, what's that all about?
Well, I think, first of all, I think I was supposed to join you earlier, and I had was having the experience that many people had, which is trying to put up a Christmas tree with a new Christmas tree base, and it was collapsing on us. At the moment you tried to
this
call,
is truly a national crisis in
yes,
the living room.
That our my daughter Julia was both the one who figured it out and heard the phone ring. So anyway, I
bless you, Julia,
for not being there earlier.
It's great to have you.
Thank you. When I was talking about Roe v. Envy, I was talking about how many Democrats look back at this campaign and say, we did everything right. We turned out a big vote in the big cities, notably in Cleveland and the county, Franklin County, around Columbus. We did all the stuff we had always wanted to do, and yet the Republicans turned out more votes. How did they do that? How did they organize the country? How did they use new marketing techniques to identify voters in the exurbs and even within Democratic areas? That
and are you suggesting with that, EJ, that it's all about technique, not the core message?
Well, I do think a lot of this does have to do with organization. In other words, I am not one of those who thinks that the Democrats' core arguments are wrong. I do think that there is a problem of sort of a pudding without theme. There's a lot of good Democratic pudding in terms of child care and health care, and we can get to what Peter Beinart was saying about foreign policy. But I think the Democrats lack sort of a core argument to pull it together. To me, there are two core arguments they should and could be making. One is, in a global economy, a lot of people over the course of their working lives are going to face challenges, switch jobs a lot,
yep.
That in a way that wouldn't have been the case 20 or 30 years ago. And that Democrats have to argue that providing people with a certain amount of security in health care, child care, after school care could actually make us a more risk-taking society, because if people have that core security, they will be able to deal with the challenges that this new economy poses.
And you've got some big people saying that, big in the business world. Michael Porter said that to us not so very long ago.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you look at China and India, we're not just losing you know, blue-collar jobs, which matter to me as a kid from Fall River down a little bit south of where you are, where we lost a lot of textile jobs over many years. We're starting to lose jobs held by very highly educated, very skilled people, because Indians and Chinese are very educated, highly skilled people.
So let's get some support in there to win. And your second core argument?
And this is where I sort of half agree and half disagree with Peter Beinart, which is some notion of progressive patriotism. After 9/11, we did change. And I think the core critique of President Bush is that he said 9/11 changed everything, but in fact it changed nothing. That instead of calling for us to come together, he called for more tax cuts for the wealthy. Instead of calling for an ethic of national service, he just said, let's go on the way we did. I'm a big fan of GI Bill politics, which I suspect would play very well where David Sirota was out in Montana, where on the one hand we ask people to give something back to their community and their nation, which is what the GI Bill did in terms of rewarding veterans. But it also says that government doesn't just create dependency. Government can create independence. And that's what we did by sending a whole generation to college, people who could never have gone to college before, and helping a whole generation buy homes and thus become part of what President Bush calls an ownership society.
Government had a lot to do
with expanding ownership, responsibility, and upward mobility.
Making that happen. And what about David Sirota's progressive economic populism? We just had a caller before the break. I think you heard the caller saying, you know, be careful, because Americans all imagine themselves becoming part of the, you know, getting into deep gravy, the affluent folks, even rich. You can scare people off with class war talk.
Right. Well, there are two kinds of populism. There's a populism that says we're primarily going to tear the rich down, and there's a populism that says we're going to contain the rich in order to lift everybody else up. And I think historically the kind of populism that's worked with Americans is a populism that says the working class, the middle class, are as good as the rich, deserve the same rights and opportunities as the rich, because we don't want to lose our sense of upward mobility as Americans. But there is a sense in which large corporations do not always serve the interests of the public. Enron is a good example. And that I think you can have a critique of those corporations that abuse their power without saying that a competitive economic system is evil. There are good things about a competitive economic system, but people have to live within certain rules and that respect the public interest. And I think the public interest is the key issue here, and that has always been part of a successful American populism.
David Serrata, is that the progressive populism you're talking about?
That's exactly right. I think that the difference, as I define it, between liberalism and progressivism on economic issues is liberalism says that we're going to use the collective community's financial resources, that is money, to create a safety net, which I'm all for. A progressive economic outlook, however, is different. It says we're going to use the power of the government as the sole authority in the land to make sure that the economy is working, to make sure that the rules are enforced.
Now, so you're for both, liberalism and progressivism.
I would argue that progressivism right now is the piece of this puzzle that hasn't been pushed. And I would say that people essentially, in their minds, they understand that there are large, powerful economic interests that are not out for their best interest. And the only institution that's able to basically meter those powers is the federal government and is government. And so I think Democrats have an opportunity here to say the Republicans are totally abdicating their responsibilities to make sure that government is enforcing the rules. The government should be enforcing the rules for the benefit of society.
There would be a little vulnerability there, I guess, in the GOP's part. Let's turn to our callers. Claudia is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Claudia. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I think that what the Democratic Party needs is a leader that can be understood for the majority of the people. I think that the biggest failure of Mr. Kerry is that he speaks a language that can be understood only by college professionals. So it fails in reaching the real middle class, and some of your speakers before mentioned my class. My wife and I have college degrees. I work in a university. She works in a private company. And we can understand his message, and we agree and disagree in several things. But what we really need is a leader, a person that can glue people together.
We've got it, Claudio, and thanks for the observation. Let me put it to David Serrata, because it kind of goes to your point. We've talked about the leader of the DNC. We'll talk about that a little bit more here. But what about the candidate? Can you put this populist message in the mouth of a John Kerry and have it work? Or even John Edwards? He was supposed to carry that flame, but it didn't burn so very bright, it seems to me.
Well, I would argue that John Edwards got as close as he did because he ran as a class-based economic populist. And I would say that, you know, obviously you have some challenges with a candidate like John Kerry. I don't think, for instance, though, that if you come from an affluent background, you can't be a populist. I mean, I think FDR had a populist economic agenda. I think that
George Bush is sitting in the White House tonight.
That's exactly right. He is a populist. He's not a progressive populist, but he's a populist. I think what you really need, and I think what the party really needs right now, and this is what I said with the DNC chair and with their national candidates, is the party desperately needs energy from outside of Washington. The party right now has become essentially a very insular cabal of the same people running around Washington with the same prescriptions. The party needs to use the energy from outside of Washington, governors and other state officials.
Those red state winners that you're talking about. Let's get another call here. Paul is calling from Nahant, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Is it possible that Beinart and Serrata and E.J. Dionne and even Jack Beatty are all in agreement here that nothing anybody has said is really excludes the points made by the others? And I think the answer is yes. I think that there is...
Pick it all up and go, you're saying.
I think there's a real good opportunity here for a very strong reinvigoration of the party.
So was this also invisible before the November vote then, Paul? If it's so obvious, why didn't Dems win?
I think John Kerry was a lousy candidate.
Okay.
I think they did a very good job of organizing and getting people to the polls. The Republicans had a lot, were just as good at that. There's no mystery there. to pick up a point that was made earlier, they should have been hammering Bush for a failure to make America one bit safer from the very beginning. But I think that the pitfall here, the danger is that the differences are going to be drawn and exaggerated. The caricatures that Peter Beinart, I'm afraid, fell prey to, they're going to be exaggerated by people who have a vested interest in maintaining their control of the party. And one of your guests was, or maybe one of your callers was alluding to that earlier. These people stay in control whether the Democrats win or lose. They get the fat.
You mean they'll call Peter a hawk, a militarist, something like that?
Right, or they'll call Governor Dean, a communist or something close.
But I don't know.
Wild-eyed liberal or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Throw the characters.
That serves the interests of people who have been unsuccessful at molding a message for the party, and also unsuccessful really in fielding or managing a candidate, and they deserve to go. And a house cleaning needs to be done.
Let's see if maybe some of that has been brewing in Florida. And Paul, thank you for your call. EJ, you watched the meeting in Lake Buena Vista pretty closely. This was looking for kind of tryouts for the next chairman of the DNC. What did you see brewing down there? Is this a party that's ready to bring in new outside of Washington blood, or same old, same old?
Well, let me just go back. First of all, I think the caller at the beginning of his comment made a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
We got to look at this election and not pretend that this was a Goldwater blowout like 1964 or McGovern blowout like 1972. A
couple of points the other way, and Kerry would be there.
Either way. So this was actually a close election. And John Kerry was trying to get elected in a circumstance of national emergency where an incumbent usually gets the benefit of the doubt. I cited my daughter earlier about 2 months before the election. She said, "Dad, we're going to lose, we being a Democratic household." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because at a time of all this trouble, Americans are not going to want to change presidents." I think that had a lot to do with this outcome. John Kerry.
And she fixes Christmas trees.
What? Yes, exactly. But I think that, and that's a, you know, that's a fairly common and I think reasonable view. And John Kerry did not look like an elitist jerk in those debates. John Kerry actually won the debates. He made that little mistake with Mary Cheney at the end, which the Republicans very shrewdly drove a truck through. But, you know, it's not like the Democratic Party represents some sort of a small minority of Americans. So I think it's very important to sort of say that at the outset. I think what you saw at the Democratic meeting this weekend is a lot of Democrats saying, okay, we did a lot of things right this year in terms of turning out the vote, in terms of being unified. I've never seen Democrats so nice to each other as they were from the convention forward. Usually Democrats form circular firing squads and try to take each other out before the election happens.
And yet the Republicans have all the real estate.
Right, but the Republicans did an exceptional job of identifying and organizing their vote, and that puts aside whatever may have happened in Ohio. And I think Democrats say, okay, we're like one generation behind, or at least one technology behind organizationally. And so what you heard from those Democrats is, we spent a campaign looking at 18 states, and we organized in 18 states. And the Republicans are organized in a much bigger part of the country. Democrats do not have strong state organizations in a lot of parts of the country.
Time to go to 50 states and maybe with a refurbed message. We got to start on that tonight, hearing what that might look like. E.J. Dionne, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be with you always.
Keep that tree standing tall. E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post. And David Sirota, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
David Sirota's piece is in The American Prospect. Jack Beatty, last thought goes to you. We've got 20 seconds here. Make it a bullet point, my friend.
I'm stumped. Yes, I realize I paraphrased Emerson earlier. I'm sorry. And I said an American president. I did not say this American president is not believed in the Middle East.
Well, we've crossed that T. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.